from the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking spokes puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare, the hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in store or at mybobs.com to play now.
Hey, fantasy football owners, I'm Matt Harmon.
And what's cracking? I'm James Coe. Join us on Reception Perception as we dive deep into wide receivers, the position that will make or break your fantasy team.
Follow and listen to Reception Perception on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back with more Hit and Run with host Chris Ronji on The Score.
And now the 3-2. Swing and a miss, strike three. Fastball got the job done. Brown strikes out Sanchez. Cubs still lead 5-3. Time for the seventh inning stretch.
Yeah, that means that there's going to be opportunities for everybody. And whether I'm starting, relieving, who knows, throwing bullpens, I can still give a chance to impact the team, help the team. And any way I can help out the guys, I'm in for it. So, I mean, I covered some innings today in a doubleheader, and I'm just grateful I got to do that. So,
I mean, you just heard him say that wherever they need him, he wants to go out there and contribute. That's the type of attitude you need if you're going to be successful in the big leagues. And Brown has been just answering the bell and really delivering over the last four outings with that minuscule ERA, just a bat over one. But it's the stuff. I mean, this guy's attacking the strike zone, also mixing in the breaking pitches as well, throwing strikes, no walks. Just a great outing today, again, solidifying the W for the Cubs.
Cubs will finish up the series. They will conclude it today. 12:45 is the pregame show here on The Score. First pitch at 1:20. It'll be Zach with Ryan Dempster on the call today. And it's time to go to The Score hotline again, presented by Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. And a couple of injury update sort of things. Seiya Suzuki today. Introducing some light baseball activity, trying to come back from the oblique strain. And as we already knew, Justin Steele throwing a live bullpen session today as he is getting closer to a return to the Cubs. And so let's bring in Carlos Pena from Marquee Sports Network, who is visiting with us on The Score. Good morning, Carlos. How are you?
Good morning. Doing great. Thanks so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
Well, it's great to have you. Love talking baseball with you. And you just heard, well, from yourself on Marquee talking about Ben Brown, who was part of the bullpen yesterday, had success as a starter too in limited action. The Cubs have a handful of guys here in the rotation that have done pretty well. And with Steele on the way back, with Tyone back, what do you think ends up happening here in terms of who remains in that rotation?
Well, I'd love to hear what Brown had to say, you know, the attitude. This is why I was exalting what he was saying. Just basically, wherever you need me, I'm willing to step in and get the job done. That's the type of mentality. If you're a young pitcher, you need to have it. You can't go out there trying to wait for a designated role. I think you're dreaming if that's the case. Now, when you go up there and you tell yourself, I am a fireman, I get paid to put fires out, and then you find yourself in a starting position, you know, starting role, then great. But the mentality is precisely what we heard Ben Brown express yesterday. That's the mentality you need to have. So young guys out there, you know, if they're listening, you know, just go out there and be an assassin for hire. That's basically what you are. If you start there, then good things will happen. Attitude is everything. And I love that type of mentality, that savage mentality, that go-getter mentality. Ben Brown has it.
Well, I know you're not coming. You have the perspective of a hitter. You had a good career as a major league hitter. But for a pitcher, you typically hear that from the younger guys, you know, those who don't have a whole lot of major league experience, where they basically say, I just want to help the team. So whatever they want from me. But as they get older and deeper into their career, they want to have a more defined role. So how do you maintain that attitude once you get into the league for a few years?
You're absolutely right that would be ideal. But if I were advising, you know, Brown right now, my whole, you know, mentality would be, hey, just stick with that. And if you find yourself in a role, never take it for granted. So that's the thing. As soon as you get comfortable as a big leaguer, whether you're a pitcher or a hitter, that's when things really start to go downhill. Because as you climb up the mountain, the moment that you feel like you have arrived, it's when you start going down. So I like always that fight. So that's my advice. Even though it's ideal, say, hey, man, I've been a starter for 5 straight years. In your head, you're always fighting. I want you to always have that type of savage mentality if you are a pitcher, and certainly if you're a hitter as well. You never should feel like you have arrived. The moment that you do, you relax, and the big leagues are the big leagues. They'll make you pay. This is incredibly competitive up here, so you got to have that survival of the fittest type of mind. Otherwise, you're going to get defeated. This is, pretty much, you want to be at the top of the food chain, you better be a predator your whole entire career.
Talking with Carlos Pena, Marquee Sports analyst, former Cubs first baseman with us here on Hit and Run. From the perspective of a guy on the outside who doesn't know anything, me, and I think for a lot of fans, looking at what happens with Kyle Hendricks today, considering this to be a very big start for him, one way or the other, how big of a start do you think this is for Hendricks to prove that he belongs in the rotation still?
This is huge. I mean, we know that he has cemented himself in the history books for the Cubs, right? He will always be talked about being a great pitcher. However, obviously, needless to say, he has been struggling. And this is the thing, when your stuff is not electric, when your stuff is not overpowering, your margin for error is very, 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 very small. So whenever he makes pitches that are at risk, you know, over the plate, hitters, you know, hitting is tough. Hitters, we will miss pitches down the middle, but we tend to miss those that are 95 miles per hour a lot more often than those that are 87. So that's what I'm trying to tell you. So for the professor, and there's a very, very specific reason why we call him the professor, is because he has to be very, very fine and calculate everything that he throws. You know, his formulas need to be executed. Otherwise, he's going to be at risk. And unfortunately, at the beginning of this year, we have seen all those pitches that were at risk. They've been getting hit hard. See all those 7 home runs here in the early going. That's just too much, you know. And this start, definitely not only for him, for his confidence, but just flat out just making decisions as Cubs front office. They're watching closely. You know, there's a lot of stake here because adjustments could be made if he goes out there and does not perform the way they would like him to, right? So it's the bitter part of this game. You know, you have to make decisions. And, you know, today pretty much could be that turning point that decides, right? How things go today, will be the decision could be made basically on what we see today. So, yes, a lot of stake. We love the professor, but at the end of the day, he needs to go out there and execute.
I mean, that's really the question I wanted to ask you is, they've been pretty proactive on a lot of things. You know, we talked about them hiring Craig Counsell, and that was an aggressive move. On something like this, for a guy who is as highly thought of by not just the organization, by the fan base, how good do you think he has to be today? You know, I don't know if you can really put a number on it. Like he's got to go 5 innings and give up no more than 4 runs or whatever it is. But how does he have to perform today in order to keep that job in the rotation, do you think?
If he goes out there and gives the Cubs a quality start, that's all that is needed. Because we cannot, I don't think the Cubs are expecting Hendricks to go out there and just mow the opposition down. And, you know, that's not the type of pitcher that he is. But if he pitches to contact and Induces weak contact. That's another one of those telltale signs of, like, you know, he missed barrels. You know, hitters were out in front, hitters were late, they were in between, they were off balance. The defense was engaged. You know, 5 complete innings, 2 runs, you know, no walks. That's the type of performance that perhaps the Cubs are expecting. Just a quality start, give the team an opportunity to win the ballgame. That's it.
Yeah, and I think we're all there's a lot of nerves behind this, I think, for many Cubs fans, maybe the organization as well, because everybody's rooting for him, not just because if he does well, the team does well, but people like him. Everybody loves Kyle Hendricks for what he did to them, or did for them. So I think there are a lot of emotions that are sort of simmering about today's start.
Yeah, it's with guys like Hendricks, it's one of those things where, man, he has been one of the biggest warriors for the past, you know, 7 years or so. You know, well, going all the way down to 2016, right? Like, you think about what he has been able to accomplish. We get attached to that, right, as fans, and rightfully so. So this is one of the most liked guys in the entire organization. As I said earlier, cemented in history as far as the Cubs are concerned. So you pull for him all the way to the end because he's a Cub. He's a Cub for life, and he will forever be. So very easy to root for Kyle Hendricks. And me being an analyst, right, like, I'm sitting here analyzing and breaking stuff down, but at the end of the day, I'm a fan, so I'm pulling very hard for him.
Carlos Pena is with us here on The Score. Want to ask you about Adbert Alzolay, who's been struggling. He's got the 4 blown saves. Yesterday was particularly devastating just because they had it in the 9th inning and you're looking for a doubleheader sweep. It didn't work out. They ended up splitting that doubleheader yesterday. How much more or how much deeper do they go with him, do you believe, before they make a decision?
No, I think here, you know, we were talking about roles earlier, right? I told you that I do not believe in roles per se, right? Like, with the idea of, hey, you're my closer no matter what. I think that's a thought of the past. It doesn't work that way anymore. What I do have is I have all these weapons that I can deploy depending on the situation, right? And Alzolay was the one that was getting the call in these high-leverage situations to seal the deal at the end of the game. So as you can see, I'm avoiding the word closer or the term or the label closer. I don't even want guys to think that way. It's like, hey man, just be ready to pitch. And it probably will be in a high leverage situation. So that's what you need to be thinking. Now, with Alzolay, now it's when you see counsel go to work and say, okay, perhaps this is a time where I have to be a little bit more careful and give him more room so that he can go out there and have a little bit more latitude. So it's not the highest leverage situations. Maybe we have a 3-run lead and then he comes in. I think we already arrived at that point. How about that? Like, look at this nasty stuff that Alzolay brings, right? The stuff is there. The stuff is sharp. The slider, the fastball, the velocity is there. But the execution is not. Maybe the strategy is not. So it's incredible how you have a guy like Alzolay, and then on the flip side, you got a guy like Hendricks who would love to have the stuff that Alzolay has. And then Alzolay would love to have the strategy engineering that Hendricks has, and you make the perfect pitcher. So everyone needs something different. Well, for Alzolay's strategy, perhaps giving him a little bit more latitude will be the better strategy right now, and work on his sequencing, on, you know, his formulation, on how he's going to go after hitters. And I think the moment has arrived where adjustments need to be made. So I don't expect him to be called upon the highest leverage situation in the games. I think that's already happening.
Talking Cubs with Carlos Pena on Hit and Run, and cleaning up in the lineup today is Michael Busch, the left-hander playing at your old position. And he's having a really, really fun and good start to this season. What is he doing right, and can he keep it up? And what I mean is doing right from a technical perspective.
Yes, I thought yesterday's at-bat was absolutely perfect. Perfect example on what happens when you go out there and you have the right approach. Because we've been talking about pitching and having the right strategy. How about when you hit? The big leagues are the big leagues for a reason. This is the highest level of competition in the whole entire universe, as far as baseball is concerned. So when you go up to the plate, you have to have a plan. You're facing tough pitching day in and day out. With Bush, it seems to me that he does not try to cover the entire strike zone. He goes up there with a very specific plan. He becomes a hunter instead of just sitting there and reacting, being ambushed every single time he goes up to the plate, which is it's futile. You have to go up there with a very specific mission. And yesterday was a perfect example. He gets down 0-2. He immediately says, okay, I know this situation. I need it to come through for my team because I can give them the lead here. So I'm going to shorten up. I'm not going to spin off of baseball. So I'm going to stay through the baseball, let it travel. Worst case scenario, I just dump it into left field. Do not be afraid to get jammed. All these things are advanced techniques for hitters. So I cannot be as aggressive perhaps when I get down later in the count. So I have to shorten up, keep things under control, swing under control, don't overswing, stay within yourself. These are all the things that he's thinking about, and then when he goes up to the plate, he gives himself a pretty good chance of succeeding. Because otherwise, you are doing the total opposite. Hitting is already hard, let alone when you go out there without no plan. See, if you plan, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail, period. Bush has been doing a great job of going out there with a very strategic plan and strategy. Every single AB, and the numbers speak for themselves.
What about the offense in total? It's been a pretty good offense. We're talking upper tier in MLB so far this year.
Yes. We heard Council post-game. He was talking about, man, we just put together some great at-bats. He went to the process. He didn't talk about, this is the results we got. Yeah, no. The process. Quality ABs back-to-back-to-back-to-back. So now, this is easy to say. Right, harder to do because we are all human and we want to see the result. We want to see results. We put the cart before horse all the time, but we know that if we want the result, then we have to focus on the process because it increases the chances of the results being a favorable one, a positive one. But the discipline it takes, the mental discipline it takes, is where you separate the men, you know, from the boys. So 1 through 9. The Cubs have been able to put together quality at-bats. And that's tough for opposing staffs, you know, pitching staffs, to navigate. And they end up, you get the results overall, you increase your chances of succeeding. And that's why you see why the Cubs are where they're at. And I don't think they're still firing in all cylinders as far as the offense is concerned. So if this continues, I expect the Cubs to be a team that scores lots of runs. I know it's early on, and we've seen great signs, but I don't think the offense is yet firing. They haven't reached their potential yet, which is a great sign of a team that's going to score a lot of runs.
Carlos Pena is with us talking Cubs here on 670 The Score. I do have one specific at-bat question, and it got a little bit of attention after it happened, and it was in Game 1. Cubs lose the lead. They've got they're threatening to score in the ninth inning in the bottom half. They've got the tying run at third, the potential game winner at second, and Alex Canario is at the plate with a 2-strike count, and he swung so hard his helmet fell off, and he struck out in that moment. And the game is not on him, but criticism is warranted in that case. He's a young hitter. In a moment like that, how much can he learn? Because I know that that's his game, right? That's just how he swings. Mm-hmm. But learning to be situational, can that be, or will it be a moment where he takes it and says, oh gosh, okay, I understand now. Maybe I should just make contact here.
Man, I guarantee you, I can bet my house on this, that was the conversation in the clubhouse after the ball game. You sit down with a young hitter and you talk about, let's talk about this situation. What does it need from you? What is it? Not a home run. You know, if you stay back and you drive the baseball middle the other way, you could possibly at least play one run, possibly bring two in. But with this type of swing, you just risked it all in the precipice without any need. That was not what was warranted at that moment. What was warranted there was like, you know what, I'm going to have this ball travel. I'm going to put the ball in play, hit it the other way, drive in and run. Just one. It ties the ball game. Now, what's crazy is that when you are that strong, sometimes, you know, I tell guys all the time, I tell them this. It's like when I go up to the plate, you know, I hit 286 home runs. And out of those 286 home runs in my career, I was never trying to hit him. I was trying to hit a line drive to the shortstop, which I never did. It was just a mentality. So for Canario, it could be like, look, I'm just playing pepper with the second baseman. Now, is that really what's going to happen? No, it just sets him and shortens him up. It keeps him on the, within himself. He's not swinging out of his shoes. Now he puts the ball in play, and lo and behold, he hits it out because he's so strong and everything is in position. So absolutely, that was the conversation. And yes, a young hitter learns from a type of moment like that one. So the next time he actually executes a better plan. So those are learning more moments, and you kind of roll with them because we know the talent that Canario has. But that conversation was had 100%.
Yeah, that's I wonder about that because even though he's young, he's taken a million at bats in his life, and he kind of, you know, he's, I don't want to say he is what he is, but he's, if he's been doing a thing a certain way his entire baseball life, how easy is it to change that? Even though you're, you know, you're at a newer level, a bigger level, and it's the competition's tougher, how easy is it to kind of change what your DNA is?
It's very difficult. As a matter of fact, I would tell them something like this. I'm like, you know, in this situation, we want to do a, let's do a slow motion swing. So you have to get ready super early, slow motion swing, and all you want to do is just meet the baseball. And he's going to look at me like, what? And what's crazy is that I know as a trainer or as a coach, that his swing's still going to be violent, right? It's still going to be, the bat speed's just going to be through the roof, even when he's think it's slow. So it's almost like, hey, man, slow is smooth, smooth is fast, let's get there. And all you're doing is withholding a little bit of your power so that you don't come out outside of the boundaries of your control. So it's incredible what the mind does. You know, as long as you give it the right intent, then your body follows. But trust me, you're absolutely right. That swing's still going to be violent, but at the very least, he is within the parameters of his control, like with his domain of competence. Because what happens to young hitters is that you get out of that, and now you are out of control, which is where you don't want to be. And that swing particularly was totally out of control. His helmet almost flew off, you know. So those are the type of conversations you have with young hitters.
Lastly, Carlos, just looking at the Cubs against the rest of the division, I know it's early. We still have about a week and a half left in April, and they are in second place. They're a game behind Milwaukee. But you look at what the other teams are, the Brewers in the lead. Reds are a good young team. The Pirates have been a decent this year, the Cardinals at the bottom of the division. Do you think that the way it is right now is close to what it's going to look like at the end of the year?
Can you please repeat that? Please repeat that. I lost you for a second.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just the division where the Cubs are now and the rest of the division. Do you think this is pretty close to what we're looking at late September?
You know, I really like the Cubs' chances. And I don't say this lightly, right? I don't say this lightly because we often say it's like who are the favorites on this division? You know, sometimes I hate that conversation because I'm like, oh wait a second. Well, number one, we can't predict baseball, but this is one thing I'm going to tell you: the Cubs have all the tools necessary to take this division. And another thing that's always said, and it's kind of like said very loosely, is the division is up for grabs, almost as if this division is weak. You know, it's the underlining statement there, right? No, this is the big leagues, right? This is the big leagues, and you don't take anything for granted. You saw what the Marlins did on that first game, and you're like, okay, this is the worst team in baseball. Nah, they got you. So as professionals, we never take anything for granted. But one thing you know before you step between the lines, it's like you look at your roster and you said, there is no reason why we shouldn't win the division. There is zero reason why we shouldn't be there at the end. So what we see right now, yes, that's what I expect out of the Cubs. And if and I guarantee you, that's what every single player with that uniform expects out of this ball club. But being totally stoic and objective about it, let's look at the roster and let's compare with the rest of the teams in this division. Why shouldn't they win it? Why? If you give me one reason why, then perhaps I'll sit down and back off of this statement. But at the I don't see a reason why they shouldn't be at the top of the division and win it.
Carlos, love talking baseball with you, man. Appreciate the insight. Thanks for talking with us today.
Always a pleasure.
Carlos Pena, Marquee Sports Analyst, and you know him as former Cubs first baseman as well, joining us here on The Score. When we come back, we're going to talk to Craig Mish, who covers the Marlins. Also, he covers Major League Baseball for MLB.com. And you know what? We'll go ahead and ask him what his thoughts are on a potential, if they were to consider it down the road, a trade between the Cubs and Marlins. Would they make good trade partners? We will talk that over when we come back. Chris Ranji in for Spiegs on The Score.
We're back with more Hit and Run with host Chris Ranji on The Score.
Here's the pitch, drilled in the air, trouble deep left center, all the way back and gone for a home run. And the Marlins have taken a 3-2 lead. As I look at the flags, they are not blowing the way they have been almost all day. De La Cruz with a home run and Miami with their first lead of the day. It is 3-2 here in the ninth inning.
That was game one, and the Cubs would go on to lose it by that very score. They would come back and win game two of the doubleheader yesterday to earn a split. They will try to take 3 of 4 against the Marlins this afternoon. We got the pregame show at 12:45. Mike Esposito has that, who, by the way, checks in to tell us that Justin Steele did, in fact, throw a bullpen session today as he is trying to come back from injury. Meanwhile, Seiya Suzuki did introduce some light baseball activity. He's trying to recover from the oblique injury, so hopefully it won't be too long for him, but as you know, oblique injuries can linger for a while. Hopefully it's not the case with him. It is time to go back to the guest hotline presented by Circa Resorts and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. We bring in Craig Mish, who covers the Marlins for MLB.com, also covers some national stuff as well. And Craig is with us on The Score. Good morning, Craig. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
We, you know, it's awesome to have you on. Love talking baseball with you as well. Have done so quite a few times over the last few years. And, you know, looking at this, the Marlins team that we're seeing now is not especially a good team at the moment. But there is one guy that I think in Chicago we do pay attention to just because we, you know, have a bit of an attachment to him in Tim Anderson. How has he been to cover so far?
Well, look, in my limited like one-on-one engagements, remember he signed, you know, kind of late into spring training, yep. Wasn't there really initially. But in my one-on-one engagements, he's been fine from the people who are there every day, and I'm not there every day. But for the people who are, they say that he's fit into the clubhouse very well. I've had that same question asked of me of people around the league, and I would say that he's, you know, meshed in like one of the other guys. So I think that's definitely a good sign as far as his performance is concerned. You know, I think it's been okay. I think that maybe it was unrealistic to think that he could go back to the player that he was when he won the batting title a few years ago. And I think it was also unrealistic to think that he was going to be the guy that he was last year. So maybe that's somewhere in the middle. And based on the contract that the Marlins gave him, I think that, you know, more or less, they could get what they paid for. And then the question would be, would another team covet him at some point if the Marlins are, you know, completely out of it in a month or two? And then where would he go from there? But I think he probably knew all along that could be the plan.
You know, it's difficult to, with the way the season has gone so far for Miami, for me personally, I don't put a lot of a team's record on the manager, but I know it's the manager's the one who usually takes the brunt of it just because they make up the lineup. The job that Skip Schumacher has done so far going back to last year. How much of it is on him, in your opinion, what's happening this year?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a fair question to ask. I think, you know, I've thought about this, and I think that any team that starts off the season this poorly, there's no question that some of it has to fall on the manager. It's one thing to say the team isn't as good as last year, and they, you know, certainly are not equipped on the field the way they were a year ago without Soler, and Berger is hurt, and then the pitching, you know, Alcantara's down, and Eury Pérez is down. And I think those things all fall into the bucket of that's not Skip's fault. But look, it's their bullpen is the worst in baseball. And he said it himself. He's not putting guys in the right spots to get people out. And we know that bullpens in baseball are fickle. Last year, the Marlins bullpen, first half of the season, probably the best in baseball. Second half, maybe not as good. This year, the worst. And that just changes from year to year, which is why it's really hard to invest the financial resources in that position too, because these guys flame out so quickly, throwing 95 to 100, and then you don't see them for a year. So, long-winded answer to your question, I think Skip has to be culpable in some of this, without a doubt. I did not think that they would be a 500 team at the end of the season, so that's not surprising, but I also didn't think that they would be on pace to win like 40 games. And you know, at that point, any manager that loses that many games is in jeopardy of losing their job.
So, is that, do you think he makes it through the season? We know that his that option year for 2025 was voided, according to the reporting. So, does that mean that he will likely be done before the end of the year, or will he make it through?
I don't know the answer to that, but I do know if they're, you know, sitting on 100 losses in August, then yeah, I would think that they probably would make a change. I don't think that you can lose that much. Almost any manager in the big leagues can lose that much. And there's actually an interesting correlation here. It's, you know, not, maybe it's a little bit apples and oranges, but in 1997, the Marlins won the World Series. You may remember this goes back a while. And then Jim Leland was, you know, who just got in the Hall of Fame. He was the manager of that team. They came back in 98 and they sold off everyone. And the team, you know, with Leland ended up having the worst season in franchise history, I believe losing like 115 games. Leland ended up leaving, going to Colorado and then to Detroit. And Leland, generally speaking, wasn't really thought to be at fault for that season. This is a little bit different, you know. Like 70% of the guys are back again this year with the Marlins. And so I would say that if their pace is 115, 120 losses, I could see a change being made. But if the team just basically plays 500 baseball the rest of the season, I don't think there would be any need. I would roll with Skip till the end.
It's tough, man. Guy was National League Manager of the Year 5 months ago, and now we're talking about him being in danger of losing his job. The this question has been asked from listeners today via the text line. If the Cubs and the Marlins would be good trade partners or likely trade partners, whether it's right at the deadline or, you know, within the next several weeks. How likely is any of that?
I don't think the Marlins are set to make any deals at the moment, and I haven't heard of any. It would also be sort of foolish for, and I think that this is why a lot of the trades are done at the deadline, is because the Marlins would be the ultimate sell low team right now. The worst record in the National League, second worst record in baseball. Virtually every player on their team outside of maybe a couple, De La Cruz and some others, underperforming. So Peter Bendix, who comes from Tampa Bay, they're in the opposite spectrum. They usually sell high, buy low. So while the Cubs and Marlins could be partners at some point, I don't foresee that happening anytime soon.
Craig Mish covers the Marlins for MLB.com. He's with us here on The Score. So looking at the National League landscape, we talked a little bit with Carlos Pena about this particular division, the National League Central. And it's sort of been one of those divisions, just like the AL Central, for years where the criticism is, well, everybody kind of stinks, and maybe there's one good team in the division, but that's it, that it's always a weak division. Do you see the National League Central that way this year too?
Yeah, I think you could see a few more wins, but I don't see a 95-win team coming from the division. I think it's sort of played out a little bit how I thought. I think the Cubs are playing a little bit better than I thought. I did not it was very hard to prognosticate the impact that Imanaga has had, and Bush for that matter, but really for Imanaga. Like, I just, you know, you never know with that. And every 5 days, this guy is incredible. So him and Steele, you know, 1-2 punch in the rotation is just a huge boost. So Cubs are playing a little bit better than I thought. Brewers are playing better than I think most people thought. Reds are about where they are. Pirates playing a little bit above. So, I mean, you could see teams in the mid-80s. The team that's the big question, I think, at this point, ironically, is the team that was favored to win the division in a lot of circles, which is the Cardinals. The Cardinals, by the way, look exactly like they did a year ago. Like, they really don't look much different. So if indeed that is the case, you have to wonder, you know, is that the team that, you know, the division's going to beat up on this year? I know it's crazy to say, but saw them in the spring, and even seeing them now, they look very similar with a couple of guys who throw a few more innings, and that's it. So 85 wins, 86 wins, maybe wins the division this year. I just don't see a juggernaut coming out of it.
I never know what to think of the Brewers, because I go into each season thinking, they're not going to be that great. And then they're always, at the end of the year, at least hanging around. If they're not winning the division, they're close to it. What do you think of them overall this year?
They do a great job in scouting and development. They draft very well. You see their players come up that get drafted and make an impact almost immediately. They have players like Bryce Terang, who is not being talked about it by anybody at the beginning of the year, and this guy has just jumped in and all of a sudden is an everyday member of their lineup. They lose, David Williams, and then they're just throwing out relievers like Uribe. Like, I mean, these are not household names, I think, to anybody listening, myself included, and lose their manager too. So it's just a testament to the way the organization is run, similar to some others. You know, Tampa Bay is an example. The Guardians is another example of how many wins they have to start the season too. So the Brewers, no matter what they do, I just think they're going to hang around because they do such a good job in the front office.
Talking with Craig Mish, covers the Marlins, also discusses national baseball, and we are visiting with him now. I'm wondering about the pitching injuries, because you've heard the Players Association, they released a statement a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, sort of blaming the pitch clock for guys getting hurt. You've heard pitchers like Justin Verlander and Tyler Glasnow, and Spencer Strider had some thoughts on it, and he mentioned the pitch clock, but other guys are talking about grip and torque and velocity and all of these things. As you look at the pitching injury situation in baseball, is it A, as dire as the narrative suggests, and B, is it the fault of the pitch clock?
I don't think the pitch clock has anything to do with it. I grew up in an era where most of the pitchers threw 250, 300 innings. And I'm at the grassroots level right now with my son, who's pitching. He pitched today, as a matter of fact. He's 11 years old. And he doesn't overwhelm or throw like super hard, like maybe some of the other kids do. And he, you know, locates and, you know, changes his pitches, four seam fastball, two seam changeup. But I got to tell you, from what I see at this level, it is all about velocity. That's all that matters, you know? And so it's unfortunate, because that's the new era that we're growing up in. Back 20, 30 years ago, Nolan Ryan threw hard, and Doc Gooden threw hard, and J.R. Richard. I mean, they were pitchers. Don't get me wrong.
And Craig, but they worked quick too. They didn't take 40 seconds in between pitches.
Yeah, and I hate to sound like the old man in the cloud, because that's not who I am here, but it's just a fact. Like, the way that you got to throw 275 innings was by throwing 91, 92. And putting too much pressure on the arm, throwing above 95 miles an hour, is just a recipe to get hurt. The arm is just simply not supposed to do that. That's not what we were born to do as humans, was to throw 100 miles an hour with an arm. And I don't think it's going to change anytime soon. I mean, what are we going to tell the guys? Okay, well, here's a rule. You can't throw 98 anymore, or 99, or you get an automatic ball. Like, what are you going to do? I don't know what the answer is. So I'm seeing it now with my son playing, and, you know, certainly I'm watching the direction that we're headed in the big leagues. And whether it's the international, I mean, you can imagine when the people are trying to sign the players internationally from the Dominican Republic or Venezuela or Cuba or wherever it is, and a pitcher throws, they won't even look at you if you're not 94, 95. Right. Like, you don't even get a look. You will not get signed. So if that's the deal, what do you think they're doing all over the world? Everyone is trying to throw as hard as they can and as fast as they can. And unless we have a doctor come in place that's able to help players do that and not get hurt, I don't think this is going to change anytime soon.
Yeah, I actually think the problem is unsolvable because guys will just throw as hard as they possibly can. You nailed all of it. It's you're not even getting a sniff if you're not touching 95, right? Like you have to at least be throwing hard to even have anybody pay any attention to you. So what's the incentive to throw 90? There isn't one. To back off, there just isn't any incentive. So I don't know how they ever fix this.
Yeah, I don't know. What's funny is I was just going through like some old baseball cards. I don't know when it was. It was probably like a week or two ago, just cleaning. You know, the wife makes you clean up the house. You know, you got to do some stuff, put this in boxes and stuff like that. And I was like thinking of what a great nickname this guy had with the Red Sox and the Expos, Oil Can Boyd, because his arm was an oil can. He just kept throwing and throwing. And I looked at the back of the card, and this is not a pitcher that was going to enter the Hall of Fame or win a Cy Young or do anything like that. And this guy is throwing 270, and this is in the 80s. It's not that long ago. 270 innings, 280 innings, 270 innings. I looked at his velos, 90, 91, 89, 88. And I wouldn't it be a better question to ask these coaches and players in the future of baseball? What would it be better for you to not have to roll through like 15 pitchers and starting pitchers in a season? Or just have a couple that could go 270 innings for you. I mean, maybe this is going to be turned up on its head at some point. But no, I mean, listen, we're glorifying the 100-mile-an-hour fastball. The Oakland A's closer, he throws 102, 103, 104. That's what we see. We don't see the guy throwing 92, getting the guy out. It's just where we're headed, and that's it.
So do you think, and before we say goodbye here, do you think that the league would concede on the pitch clock and say, well, we'll add 5 seconds, or maybe concede on the tacky stuff so that guys can get a better grip and they're not torquing as much? Is it possible they'll go the other direction on those?
You know, the sticky and tack, I don't know, maybe that's something, but no way on the pitch clock. That's never getting changed. These games are awesome. They're over
in
2 hours, and people are out of the games, and the ratings are going to be better because people are more engaged. It's not the best in-person. I mean, I personally think it's covering it is obviously the best in-person experience because you're in and out in 2.5. But no way. This pitch clock is here to stay. The games are shorter. They're more compact. There's more action in the games because of the bases. But I don't correlate the injuries to the pitch clock. Listen, there are a lot smarter people than me, and I'm not a pitching coach. And if the players are saying it, I think that we should give credence to it. But I have no data as we speak to back that up at the moment. I think it's because guys just want to throw as hard as they can, as fast as they can. And that's being taught at 14 years old and 15 years old. And by the time they get to the big leagues, by the way, it ain't even having one Tommy John surgery anymore. It's having two Tommy John surgeries now. It's crazy.
Craig Mish, appreciate your time as always. Thanks for talking with us.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Craig Mish covers the Miami Marlins, also covers Major League Baseball. He's exceptional. Really good stuff. We are going to also speak with Sahadev Sharma in the next hour. We're getting closer to Cubs baseball. We are less than an hour away from the pregame show. Mike Esposito will have that. Then Zach Zaidman and Ryan Dempster have the call as the Cubs try to take 3 of 4 from the visiting Marlins. I'm Chris Ranji filling in for Matt Spiegel. And by the way, you know what week it is? It's draft week. That's right. Caleb Williams is about to become a Bear. And the draft coverage here on The Score is presented by ChevyDrivesChicago.com and the number one draft pick, Chevy Silverado, the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. I'm Chris Ranji, in for Matt Spiegel. This is Hit and Run on The Score.
We're back with more Hit and Run with host Chris Ranji on The Score.
That's right. You know what happens here? Sahadev Sharma is going to join us. We're going to talk a little Cubs baseball when we come back. Getting closer and closer to the pregame show. They will be taking on the Marlins, finishing up the series at Wrigley Field. 12:45 is the pregame. Sahadev Sharma, Cubs baseball. We're talking it next. I'm Chris Ranji on The Score.
Hey, fantasy football owners, I'm Matt Harmon.
And what's cracking up, James Coe? Join us on Reception Perception as we dive deep into wide receivers, the position that will make or break your fantasy team.
Follow and listen to Reception Perception on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
From the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking spokes puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare, the hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in store or at mybobs.com to play now.
In case we haven't met, I'm Dino Colombo. I represent people hurt by a truck. It's what we do every day. Busy roads, big trucks, bigger risks. Don't face it alone. Hurt by a truck? Call Colombo Law.
We're back with more Hit and Run with host Chris Ronji on The Score.
And now the 3-2. Swing and a miss. Strike three. Fastball got the job done. Brown strikes out Sanchez. Cubs still lead 5-3. Time for the seventh inning stretch.
Yeah, that means that there's going to be opportunities for everybody. And whether I'm starting, relieving, who knows, throwing bullpens, I can still give a chance to impact the team, help the team. And any way I can help out the guys, I'm in for it. So, I mean, I covered some innings today in a doubleheader, and I'm just grateful I got to do that. So,
I mean, you just heard him say that wherever they need him, he wants to go out there and contribute. That's the type of attitude you need if you're going to be successful in the big leagues. And Brown has been just answering the bell and really delivering over the last four outings for that minuscule ERA, just a bat over one. But it's the stuff. I mean, this guy's attacking the strike zone, also mixing in the breaking pitches as well, throwing strikes, no walks. Just a great outing today, again, solidifying the W for the Cubs.
Cubs will finish up the series. They will conclude it today. 12:45 is the pregame show here on The Score. First pitch at 1:20. It'll be Zach with Ryan Dempster on the call today. And it's time to go to The Score hotline again, presented by Circa Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. And a couple of injury update sort of things. Seiya Suzuki today introducing some light baseball activity, trying to come back from the oblique strain. And as we already knew, Justin Steele throwing a live bullpen session today as he is getting closer to a return to the Cubs. And so let's bring in Carlos Pena from Marquee Sports Network, who is visiting with us on The Score. Good morning, Carlos. How are you?
Good morning. Doing great. Thanks so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
Well, it's great to have you. Love talking baseball with you. And you just heard, well, from yourself on Marquee talking about Ben Brown, who was part of the bullpen yesterday, had success as a starter too in limited action. The Cubs have a handful of guys here in the rotation that have done pretty well. And with Steele on the way back, with Tyone back, what do you think ends up happening here in terms of who remains in that rotation?
Well, I'd love to hear what Brown had to say, you know, the attitude. This is why I was exalting what he was saying. Just basically, wherever you need me, I'm willing to step in and get the job done. That's the type of mentality. If you're a young pitcher, you need to have it. You can't go out there trying to wait for a designated role. I think you're dreaming if that's the case. Now, when you go up there and you tell yourself, I am a fireman, I get paid to put fires out, and then you find yourself in a starting position, you know, starting role, then great. But the mentality is precisely what we heard Ben Brown express yesterday. That's the mentality you need to have. So young guys out there, you know, if they're listening, you know, just go out there and be an assassin for hire. That's basically what you are. If you start there, then good things will happen. Attitude is everything. And I love that type of mentality, that savage mentality, that go-getter mentality. Ben Brown has it.
Well, I know you're not coming. You had the perspective of a hitter. You had a good career as a major league hitter. But for a pitcher, you typically hear that from the younger guys, you know, those who don't have a whole lot of major league experience, where they basically say, I just want to help the team. So whatever they want from me. But as they get older and deeper into their career, they want to have a more defined role. So how do you maintain that attitude once you get into the league for a few years?
You're absolutely right that would be ideal. But if I were advising, you know, Brown right now, my whole, you know, mentality would be, hey, just stick with that. And if you find yourself in a role, never take it for granted. So that's the thing. As soon as you get comfortable as a big leaguer, whether you're a pitcher or a hitter, that's when things really start to go downhill. Because as you climb up the mountain, the moment that you feel like you have arrived, it's when you start going down. So I like always that fight. So that's my advice. Even though it's ideal, say, hey, man, I've been a starter for 5 straight years. In your head, you're always fighting. I want you to always have that type of savage mentality if you are a pitcher, and certainly if you're a hitter as well. You never should feel like you have arrived. The moment that you do, you relax, and the big leagues are the big leagues. They'll make you pay. This is incredibly competitive up here, so you got to have that survival of the fittest type of mind. Otherwise, you're going to get defeated. This is, pretty much, you want to be at the top of the food chain, you better be a predator your whole entire career.
Talking with Carlos Pena, Marquee Sports analyst, former Cubs first baseman with us here on Hit and Run. From the perspective of a guy on the outside who doesn't know anything, me, and I think for a lot of fans, looking at what happens with Kyle Hendricks today, considering this to be a very big start for him, one way or the other, how big of a start do you think this is for Hendricks to prove that he belongs in the rotation still?
This is huge. I mean, we know that he has cemented himself in the history books for the Cubs, right? He will always be talked about being a great pitcher. However, obviously, needless to say, he has been struggling. And this is the thing, when your stuff is not electric, when your stuff is not overpowering, your margin for error is very, 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 very small. So whenever he makes pitches that are at risk, you know, over the plate, hitters, you know, hitting is tough. Hitters, we will miss pitches down the middle, but we tend to miss those that are 95 miles per hour a lot more often than those that are 87. So that's what I'm trying to tell you. So for the professor, and there's a very, very specific reason why we call him the professor, is because he has to be very, very fine and calculate everything that he throws. You know, his formulas need to be executed. Otherwise, he's going to be at risk. And unfortunately, at the beginning of this year, we have seen all those pitches that were at risk, they've been getting hit hard. See all those 7 home runs here in the early going. That's just too much, you know. And this start, definitely not only for him, for his confidence, but just flat out just making decisions as Cubs front office. They're watching closely. You know, there's a lot of stake here because adjustments could be made if he goes out there and does not perform the way they would like him to, right? So it's the bitter part of this game. You know, you have to make decisions. And, you know, today pretty much could be that turning point that decides, right? How things go today, will be the decision could be made basically on what we see today. So, yes, a lot of stake. We love the professor, but at the end of the day, he needs to go out there and execute.
I mean, that's really the question I wanted to ask you is, they've been pretty proactive on a lot of things. You know, we talked about them hiring Craig Counsell, and that was an aggressive move. On something like this, for a guy who is as highly thought of by not just the organization, by the fan base, how good do you think he has to be today you know, I don't know if you can really put a number on it. Like he's got to go five innings and give up no more than four runs or whatever it is. But how does he have to perform today in order to keep that job in the rotation, do you think?
If he goes out there and gives the Cubs a quality start, that's all that is needed. Because we cannot, I don't think the Cubs are expecting Hendricks to go out there and just mow the opposition down. And, you know, that's not the type of pitcher that he is. But if he pitches to contact and induces weak contact, that's another one of those telltale signs of, like, you know, he missed barrels. You know, hitters were out in front, hitters were late, they were in between, they were off balance, the defense was engaged. You know, five complete innings, two runs, you know, no walks. That's the type of performance that perhaps the Cubs are expecting. Just a quality start, give the team an opportunity to win the ballgame. That's it.
Yeah, and I think we're all there's a lot of nerves behind this, I think, for many Cubs fans, maybe the organization as well, because everybody's rooting for him, not just because if he does well, the team does well, but people like him. Everybody loves Kyle Hendricks for what he did to them, or did for them. So I think there are a lot of emotions that are sort of simmering about today's start.
Yeah, it's with guys like Hendricks, it's one of those things where, man, he has been one of the biggest warriors for the past, you know, 7 years or so. You know, well, going all the way down to 2016, right? Like, you think about what he has been able to accomplish, we get attached to that, right, as fans, and rightfully so. So this is one of the most liked guys in the entire organization. As I said earlier, cemented in history as far as the Cubs are concerned. So you pull for him all the way to the end because he's a Cub. He's a Cub for life, and he will forever be. So very easy to root for Kyle Hendricks. And me being an analyst, right, like I'm sitting here analyzing and breaking stuff down, but at the end of the day, I'm a fan, so I'm pulling very hard for him.
Carlos Pena is with us here on The Score. Want to ask you about Adbert Alzolay, who's been struggling. He's got the four blown saves. Yesterday was particularly devastating just because they had it in the ninth inning and you're looking for a doubleheader sweep. It didn't work out. They ended up splitting that doubleheader yesterday. How much more or how much deeper do they go with him, do you believe, before they make a decision?
No, I think here, you know, we're talking about Rolls earlier, right? I told you that I do not believe in Rolls per se, right? Like with the idea of, hey, you're my closer no matter what. I think that's a thought of the past. It doesn't work that way anymore. What I do have is I have all these weapons that I can deploy depending on the situation, right? And Alzolay was the one that was getting the call in these high leverage situations to seal the deal at the end of the game. So as you can see, I'm avoiding the word closer or the term or the label closer. I don't even want guys to think that way. It's like, hey man, just be ready to pitch. And it probably will be in a high leverage situation. So that's what you need to be thinking. Now with Alzolay, now it's when you see counsel go to work and say, okay, perhaps this is a time where I have to be a little bit more careful and give him more room so that he can go out there and have a little bit more latitude. So it's not the highest leverage situations. Maybe we have a three-run lead and then he comes in. I think we already arrived at that point. How about that? Like, look at this nasty stuff that Alzolay brings, right? The stuff is there. The stuff is sharp. The slider, the fastball, the velocity is there. But the execution is not. Maybe the strategy is not. So it's incredible how you have a guy like Alzolay, and then on the flip side, you got a guy like Hendricks who would love to have the stuff that Alzolay has. And then Alzolay would love to have the strategy engineering that Hendricks has, and you make the perfect pitcher. So everyone needs something different. Well, for Alzolay's strategy, perhaps giving him a little bit more latitude will be the better strategy right now, and work on his sequencing, on, you know, his formulation, on how he's going to go after hitters. And I think the moment has arrived where adjustments need to be made. So I don't expect him to be called upon the highest leverage situation in the games. I think that's already happening.
talking Cubs with Carlos Pena on Hit and Run, and cleaning up in the lineup today is Michael Busch, the left-hander playing at your old position, and he's having a really, really fun and good start to this season. What is he doing right, and can he keep it up? And what I mean is doing right from a technical perspective.
Yes, I thought yesterday's at-bat was absolutely perfect. Perfect example on what happens when you go out there and you have the right approach. Because we've been talking about pitching and having the right strategy. How about when you hit? The big leagues are the big leagues for a reason. This is the highest level of competition in the whole entire universe as far as baseball is concerned. So when you go up to the plate, you have to have a plan. You're facing tough pitching day in and day out. With Busch, it seems to me that he does not try to cover the entire strike zone. He goes up there with a very specific plan. He becomes a hunter instead of just sitting there and reacting, being ambushed every single time he goes up to the plate, which is it's futile. You have to go up there with a very specific mission. And yesterday was a perfect example. He gets down 0-2. He immediately says, okay, I know this situation. I need it to come through for my team because I can give him the lead here. So I'm going to shorten up. I'm not going to spin off of baseball. So I'm going to stay through the baseball, let it travel. Worst case scenario, I just dump it into left field. Do not be afraid to get jammed. All these things are advanced techniques for hitters. So I cannot be as aggressive perhaps when I get down later in the count. So I have to shorten up, keep things under control, swing under control, don't overswing, stay within yourself. These are all the things that he's thinking about, and then when he goes up to the plate, he gives himself a pretty good chance of succeeding. Because otherwise, you are doing the total opposite. Hitting is already hard, let alone when you go out there without no plan. See, if you plan, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail, period. Busch has been doing a great job of going out there with a very strategic plan and strategy, every single AB, and the numbers speak for themselves.
What about the offense in total? It's been a pretty good offense. We're talking upper tier in MLB so far this year.
Yes. We heard Council post-game. He was talking about, man, we just put together some great at-bats. He went to the process. He didn't talk about, this is the results we got. Yeah, no. The process. Quality ABs back-to-back-to-back-to-back. So, now, this is easy to say. Right, harder to do because we are all human and we want to see the result. We want to see results. We put the cart before horse all the time, but we know that if we want the result, then we have to focus on the process because it increases the chances of the results being a favorable one, a positive one. But the discipline it takes, the mental discipline it takes, is where you separate the men, you know, from the boys. So 1 through 9. The Cubs have been able to put together quality at-bats. And that's tough for opposing staffs, you know, pitching staffs, to navigate. And they end up, you get the results overall, you increase your chances of succeeding. And that's why you see why the Cubs are where they're at. And I don't think they're still firing in all cylinders as far as the offense is concerned. So if this continues, I expect the Cubs to be a team that scores lots of runs. I know it's early on, and we've seen great signs, but I don't think the offense is yet firing. They haven't reached their potential yet, which is a great sign of a team that's going to score a lot of runs.
Carlos Pena is with us talking Cubs here on 670 The Score. I do have one specific at-bat question, and it got a little bit of attention after it happened, and it was in Game 1. Cubs lose the lead. They've got they're threatening to score in the ninth inning in the bottom half. They've got the tying run at third, the potential game winner at second, and Alex Canario is at the plate with a 2-strike count, and he swung so hard his helmet fell off, and he struck out in that moment. And the game is not on him, but I think criticism is warranted in that case. He's a young hitter. In a moment like that, how much can he learn? Because I know that that's his game, right? That's just how he swings. Mm-hmm. But learning to be situational, can that be, or will it be a moment where he takes it and says, oh, gosh, okay, I understand now. Maybe I should just make contact here.
Man, I guarantee you, I can bet my house on this, that that was the conversation in the clubhouse after the ball game. You sit down with the young hitter and you talk about, let's talk about this situation. What does it need from you? What is it? Not a home run. You know, if you stay back and you drive the baseball middle the other way, you could possibly at least plate one run, possibly bring two in. But with this type of swing, you just risked it all in the precipice without any need. That was not what was warranted at that moment. What was warranted there was like, you know what, I'm going to let this ball travel. I'm going to put the ball in play, hit it the other way, drive in a run. Just one. It ties the ball game. Now, what's crazy is that when you are that strong, sometimes, you know, I tell guys all the time, I tell them this. It's like when I go up to the plate, you know, I hit 286 home runs. And out of those 286 home runs in my career, I was never trying to hit him. I was trying to hit a line drive to the shortstop, which I never did. It was just a mentality. So for Canario, it could be like, look, I'm just playing pepper with the second baseman. Now, is that really what's going to happen? No, it just sets him and shortens him up. It keeps him within himself. He's not swinging out of his shoes. Now he puts the ball in play, and lo and behold, he hits it out because he's so strong and everything is in position. So absolutely, that was the conversation. And yes, a young hitter learns from a type of moment like that one. So the next time he actually executes a better plan. So those are learning moments, and you kind of roll with them because we know the talent that Canario has. But that conversation was had 100%.
Yeah, that's I wonder about that because even though he's young, he's taken a million at bats in his life, and he kind of, you know, he's, I don't want to say he is what he is, but he's, if he's been doing a thing a certain way his entire baseball life, how easy is it to change that? Even though you're, you know, you're at a newer level, a bigger level, and it's the competition's tougher, how easy is it to kind of change what your DNA is?
It's very difficult. As a matter of fact, I would tell him something like this. I'm like, you know, in this situation, we want to do a, let's do a slow motion swing. So you have to get ready super early, slow motion swing, and all you want to do is just meet the baseball. And he's going to look at me like, what? And what's crazy is that I know as a trainer or as a coach that his swing's still going to be violent, right? It's still going to be, the bat speed is just going to be through the roof, even when he's thinking it's slow. So it's almost like, hey, man, slow is smooth. Smooth is fast. Let's get there. And all you're doing is withholding a little bit of your power so that you don't come outside of the boundaries of your control. So it's incredible what the mind does. You know, as long as you give it the right intent, then your body follows. But trust me, you're absolutely right. That swing's still going to be violent, but at the very least, he is within the parameters of his control, like with his domain of competence. Because what happens to young hitters is that you get out of that, and now you are out of control, which is where you don't want to be. And that swing particularly was totally out of control. His helmet almost flew off. You know, so those are the type of conversations you have with young hitters.
Lastly, Carlos, just looking at the Cubs against the rest of the division, I know it's early. We still have about a week and a half left in April, and they are in second place. They're a game behind Milwaukee. But you look at what the other teams are, the Brewers in the lead. Reds are a good young team. The Pirates have been a decent this year. The Cardinals at the bottom of the division. Do you think that the way it is right now is close to what it's going to look like at the end of the year?
Can you please repeat that? Please repeat that. I lost you for a second.
Oh, I'm sorry. Just the division where the Cubs are now and the rest of the division. Do you think this is pretty close to what we're looking at late September?
You know, I really like the Cubs' chances. And I don't say this lightly, right? I don't say this lightly because we often say it's like who are the favorites on this division? You know, sometimes I hate that conversation because I'm like, oh wait a second. Number one, we can't predict baseball, but this is one thing I'm going to tell you: the Cubs have all the tools necessary to take this division. And another thing that's always said, and it's kind of like said very loosely, is the division is up for grabs. almost as if this division is weak. You know, it's the underlining statement there, right? No, this is the big leagues, right? This is the big leagues, and you don't take anything for granted. You saw what the Marlins did on that first game, and you're like, okay, this is the worst team in baseball. Nah, they got you. So as professionals, we never take anything for granted. But one thing you know before you step between the lines, it's like you look at your roster and you said, there is no reason why we shouldn't win the division. There is zero reason why we shouldn't be there at the end. So what we see right now, yes, that's what I expect out of the Cubs. And if I guarantee you, that's what every single player with that uniform expects out of this ball club. But being totally stoic and objective about it, let's look at the roster and let's compare it with the rest of the teams in this division. Why shouldn't they win it? Why? If you give me one reason why, then perhaps I'll sit down and back off of this statement. But at the I don't see a reason why they shouldn't be at the top of the division and win it.
Carlos, love talking baseball with you, man. Appreciate the insight. Thanks for talking with us today.
Always a pleasure.
Carlos Pena, Marquee Sports Analyst, and you know him as former Cubs first baseman as well, joining us here on The Score. When we come back, we're going to talk to Craig Mish, who covers the Marlins. Also, he covers Major League Baseball for MLB.com. And you know what? We'll go ahead and ask him what his thoughts are on a potential, if they were to consider it down the road, a trade between the Cubs and Marlins. Would they make good trade partners? We will talk that over when we come back. Chris Ranji in for Spiegs on The Score.
We're back with more Hit and Run with host Chris Ranji on The Score.
Here's the pitch, drilled in the air, trouble deep left center, all the way back and gone for a home run. And the Marlins have taken a 3-2 lead. As I look at the flags, they are not blowing the way they have been almost all day. De La Cruz with a home run and Miami with their first lead of the day. It is 3-2 here in the ninth inning.
That was game one, and the Cubs would go on to lose it by that very score. They would come back and win game two of the doubleheader yesterday to earn a split. They will try to take 3 of 4 against the Marlins this afternoon. We got the pregame show at 12:45. Mike Esposito has that, who, by the way, checks in to tell us that Justin Steele did, in fact, throw a bullpen session today as he is trying to come back from injury. Meanwhile, Seiya Suzuki did introduce some light baseball activity. He's trying to recover from the oblique injury, so hopefully it won't be too long for him, but as you know, oblique injuries can linger for a while. Hopefully it's not the case with him. It is time to go back to the guest hotline presented by Circa Resorts and Casino in Las Vegas, home of the world's largest sports book. We bring in Craig Mish, who covers the Marlins for MLB.com, also covers some national stuff as well. And Craig is with us on The Score. Good morning, Craig. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
We, you know, it's awesome to have you on. Love talking baseball with you as well. Have done so quite a few times over the last few years. And, you know, looking at this, the Marlins team that we're seeing now is not especially a good team at the moment. But there is one guy that I think in Chicago we do pay attention to just because we, you know, have a bit of an attachment to him in Tim Anderson. How has he been to cover so far?
Well, look, in my limited like one-on-one engagements, remember he signed, you know, kind of late into spring training, yep. Wasn't there really initially. But in my one-on-one engagements, he's been fine from the people who are there every day, and I'm not there every day. But for the people who are, they say that he's fit into the clubhouse very well. I've had that same question asked of me of people around the league, and I would say that he's, you know, meshed in like one of the other guys. So I think that's definitely a good sign as far as his performance is concerned. You know, I think it's been okay. I think that maybe it was unrealistic to think that he could go back to the player that he was when he won the batting title a few years ago. And I think it was also unrealistic to think that he was going to be the guy that he was last year. So maybe that's somewhere in the middle. And based on the contract that the Marlins gave him, I think that, you know, more or less, they could get what they paid for. And then the question would be, would another team covet him at some point if the Marlins are, you know, completely out of it in a month or two? And then where would he go from there? But I think he probably knew all along that could be the plan.
You know, it's difficult to, with the way the season has gone so far for Miami, for me personally, I don't put a lot of a team's record on the manager, but I know it's the manager's the one who usually takes the brunt of it just because they make up the lineup. The job that Skip Schumacher has done so far going back to last year, how much of it is on him, in your opinion, what's happening this year?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a fair question to ask. I think, you know, I've thought about this, and I think that any team that starts off the season this poorly, there's no question that some of it has to fall on the manager. It's one thing to say the team isn't as good as last year, and they, you know, certainly are not equipped on the field the way they were a year ago without Soler, and Berger is hurt, and then the pitching, you know, Alcantara is down, and Eury Pérez is down. And I think those things all fall into the bucket of that's not Skip's fault. But look, it's their bullpen is the worst in baseball, and he said it himself. He's not putting guys in the right spots to get people out. And we know that bullpens in baseball are fickle. Last year, the Marlins bullpen, first half of the season, probably the best in baseball. Second half, maybe not as good. This year, the worst. And that just changes from year to year, which is why it's really hard to invest the financial resources in that position, too, because these guys flame out so quickly, throwing 95 to 100, and then you don't see them for a year. So, long-winded answer to your question, I think Skip has to be culpable in some of this, without a doubt. I did not think that they would be a 500 team at the end of the season, so that's not surprising, but I also didn't think that they would be on pace to win like 40 games. And you know, at that point, any manager that loses that many games is in jeopardy of losing their job.
So is that, do you think he makes it through the season? We know that his that option year for 2025 was voided according to the reporting. So does that mean that he will likely be done before the end of the year, or will he make it through?
I don't know the answer to that, but I do know if they're, you know, sitting on 100 losses in August, then yeah, I would think that they probably would make a change. I don't think that you can lose that much. Almost any manager in the big leagues can lose that much. And there's actually an interesting correlation here. It's, you know, not, maybe it's a little bit apples and oranges, but in 1997, the Marlins won the World Series. You may remember this goes back a while. And then Jim Leland was, you know, who just got in the Hall of Fame. He was the manager of that team. They came back in 98 and they sold off everyone. And the team, you know, with Leland ended up having the worst season in franchise history. I believe losing like 115 games. Leland ended up leaving, going to Colorado and then to Detroit. And Leland, generally speaking, wasn't really thought to be at fault for that season. This is a little bit different, you know. Like 70% of the guys are back again this year with the Marlins. And so I would say that if their pace is 115, 120 losses, I could see a change being made. But if the team just basically plays 500 baseball the rest of the season, I don't think there would be any need. I would roll with Skip till the end.
It's tough, man. Guy was National League Manager of the Year 5 months ago, and now we're talking about him being in danger of losing his job. The this question has been asked from listeners today via the text line. If the Cubs and the Marlins would be good trade partners or likely trade partners, whether it's right at the deadline or, you know, within the next several weeks. How likely is any of that?
I don't think the Marlins are set to make any deals at the moment, and I haven't heard of any. It would also be sort of foolish and I think that this is why a lot of the trades are done at the deadline, is because the Marlins would be the ultimate sell low team right now. The worst record in the National League, second worst record in baseball. Virtually every player on their team outside of maybe a couple, De La Cruz and some others, underperforming. So Peter Bendix, who comes from Tampa Bay, they're in the opposite spectrum. They usually sell high, buy low. So while the Cubs and Marlins could be partners at some point, I don't foresee that happening anytime soon.
Craig Mish covers the Marlins for MLB.com. He's with us here on The Score. So looking at the National League landscape. We talked a little bit with Carlos Pena about, this particular division, the National League Central. And it's sort of been one of those divisions, just like the AL Central, for years where the criticism is, well, everybody kind of stinks, and maybe there's one good team in the division, but that's it, that it's always a weak division. Do you see the National League Central that way this year, too?
Yeah, I think you could see a few more wins, but I don't see a 95-win team coming from the division. I think it's sort of played out a little bit how I thought. I think the Cubs are playing a little bit better than I thought. I did not – it was very hard to prognosticate the impact that Imanaga has had, and Bush for that matter, but really for Imanaga. Like, I just – you know, you never know with that. And every 5 days, this guy is incredible, so – him and Steele, you know, 1-2 punch in the rotation is just a huge boost. So Cubs are playing a little bit better than I thought. Brewers are playing better than I think most people thought. Reds are about where they are. Pirates playing a little bit above. So, I mean, you could see teams in the mid-80s. The team that's the big question, I think, at this point, ironically, is the team that was favored to win the division in a lot of circles, which is the Cardinals. The Cardinals, by the way, look exactly like they did a year ago. Like, they really don't look much different. So if indeed that is the case, you have to wonder, you know, is that the team that, you know, the division's going to beat up on this year? I know it's crazy to say, but saw them in the spring and even seeing them now, they look very similar with a couple of guys who throw a few more innings and that's it. So 85 wins, 86 wins, maybe wins the division this year. I just don't see a juggernaut coming out of it.
I never know what to think of the Brewers because I go into each season thinking, they're not going to be that great. And then they're always, at the end of the year, at least hanging around. If they're not winning the division, they're close to it. What do you think of them overall this year?
They do a great job in scouting and development. They draft very well. You see their players come up that get drafted and make an impact almost immediately. They have players like Bryce Terang, who is not being talked about it by anybody at the beginning of the year, and this guy has just jumped in and all of a sudden is an everyday member of their lineup. They lose, Devin Williams, and then they're just throwing out relievers like Uribe. Like, I mean, these are not household names, I think, to anybody listening, myself included, and lose their manager too. So it's just a testament to the way the organization is run. Similar to some others. You know, Tampa Bay is an example. The Guardians is another example. Look how many wins they have to start the season two. So the Brewers, no matter what they do, I just think they're going to hang around because they do such a good job in the front office.
Talking with Craig Mish, covers the Marlins, also discusses national baseball, and we are visiting with him now. I'm wondering about the pitching injuries because you've heard the Players Association, they released a statement a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, sort of blaming the pitch clock for guys getting hurt. You've heard pitchers like Justin Verlander and Tyler Glasnow, and Spencer Strider had some thoughts on it, and he mentioned the pitch clock, but other guys are talking about grip and torque and velocity and all of these things. As you look at the pitching injury situation in baseball, is it A, as dire as the narrative suggests, and B, is it the fault of the pitch clock?
I don't think the pitch clock has anything to do with it. I grew up in an era where most of the pitchers threw 250, 300 innings. And I'm at the grassroots level right now with my son who's pitching. He pitched today, as a matter of fact. He's 11 years old. And he doesn't overwhelm or throw like super hard, like maybe some of the other kids do. And he, you know, locates and, you know, changes his pitches, four-seam fastball, two-seam changeup. But I got to tell you, from what I see at this level, it is all about velocity. That's all that matters, you know? And so it's unfortunate because that's the new era that we're growing up in. Back 20, 30 years ago, Nolan Ryan threw hard and Doc Gooden threw hard and J.R. Richard. I mean, they were pitchers. Don't get me wrong.
And Craig, but they worked quick too. They didn't take 40 seconds in between pitches.
Yeah. And I hate to sound like the old man in the cloud, cause that's not who I am here, but it's just a fact. Like the way that you got to throw 275 innings was by throwing 91, 92 and putting too much pressure on the arm, throwing above 95 miles an hour is just a recipe to get hurt. The arm is just simply not supposed to do that. that's not what we were born to do as humans, was to throw 100 miles an hour with an arm. And I don't think it's going to change anytime soon. I mean, what are we going to tell the guys? Okay, well, here's a rule. You can't throw 98 anymore or 99, or you get an automatic ball. Like, what are you going to do? I don't know what the answer is. So I'm seeing it now with my son playing, and you know, certainly I'm watching the direction that we're headed in the big leagues. And whether it's the international, I mean, you can imagine when the people are trying to sign the players internationally from the Dominican Republic or Venezuela or Cuba or wherever it is, and a pitcher throws, they won't even look at you if you're not 94, 95. Right. Like, you don't even get a look. You will not get signed. So if that's the deal, what do you think they're doing all over the world? Everyone is trying to throw as hard as they can and as fast as they can. And unless we have a doctor come in place that's able to help players do that and not get hurt, I don't think this is going to change anytime soon.
Yeah, I actually think the problem is unsolvable because guys will just throw as hard as they possibly can. You nailed all of it. It's, you're not even getting a sniff if you're not touching 95, right? Like, you have to at least be throwing hard to even have anybody pay any attention to you. So what's the incentive to throw, 90? There isn't one. To back off, there just isn't any incentive. So I don't know how they ever fix this.
Yeah, I don't know. As funny as I was just going through like some old baseball cards. I don't know when it was. It was probably like a week or two ago, just cleaning. You know, the wife makes you clean up the house. You know, you got to do some stuff, put this in boxes and stuff like that. And I was like thinking of what a great nickname this guy had with the Red Sox and the Expos, Oil Can Boyd, because his arm was an oil can. He just kept throwing and throwing. And I looked at the back of the card, and this is not a pitcher that was going to enter the Hall of Fame or win a Cy Young or do anything like that. And this guy is throwing 270, and this is in the 80s. It's not that long ago. 270 innings, 280 innings, 270 innings. I looked at his velos, 90, 91, 89, 88. And I wouldn't it be a better question to ask these coaches and players in the future of baseball? What would it be better for you to not have to roll through like 15 pitchers and starting pitchers in a season? Or just have a couple that could go 270 innings for you. I mean, maybe this is going to be turned up on its head at some point. But no, I mean, listen, we're glorifying the 100-mile-an-hour fastball. The Oakland A's closer, he throws 102, 103, 104. That's what we see. We don't see the guy throwing 92, getting the guy out. It's just where we're headed, and that's it.
So do you think, and before we say goodbye here, do you think that the league would concede on the pitch clock and say, well, we'll add 5 seconds, or maybe concede on the tacky stuff so that guys can get a better grip and they're not torquing as much? Is it possible they'll go the other direction on those?
You know, the sticky and tack, I don't know, maybe that's something, but no way on the pitch clock. That's never getting changed. These games are awesome. They're over and done
right.
In 2 hours, and people are out of the games, and the ratings are going to be better because people are more engaged. It's not the best in-person. I mean, I personally think it's covering it is obviously the best in-person experience because you're in and out in 2.5. But no way. This pitch clock is here to stay. The games are shorter. They're more compact. There's more action in the games because of the bases. But I don't correlate the injuries to the pitch clock. Listen, there are a lot smarter people than me, and I'm not a pitching coach. And if the players are saying it, I think that we should give credence to it. But I have no data as we speak to back that up at the moment. I think it's because guys just want to throw as hard as they can, as fast as they can. And that's being taught at 14 years old and 15 years old. And by the time they get to the big leagues, by the way, it ain't even having one Tommy John surgery anymore. It's having two Tommy John surgeries now. It's crazy.
Craig Mish, appreciate your time as always. Thanks for talking with us.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Craig Mish covers the Miami Marlins, also covers Major League Baseball. He's exceptional. Really good stuff. We are going to also speak with Sahadev Sharma in the next hour. We're getting closer to Cubs baseball. We are less than an hour away from the pregame show. Mike Esposito will have that. Then Zach Zaidman and Ryan Dempster have the call as the Cubs try to take 3 of 4 from the visiting Marlins. I'm Chris Ranji filling in for Matt Spiegel. And by the way, you know what week it is? It's draft week. That's right. Caleb Williams is about to become a Bear. And the draft coverage here on The Score is presented by ChevyDrivesChicago.com and the number one draft pick, Chevy Silverado, the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. I'm Chris Ranji, in for Matt Spiegel. This is Hit and Run on the Score.
We're back with more Hit and Run with host Chris Ranji on the Score.
That's right. You know what happens here? Sahadev Sharma is going to join us. We're going to talk a little Cubs baseball when we come back. Getting closer and closer to the pregame show. They will be taking on the Marlins, finishing up the series at Wrigley Field. 12:45 is the pregame. Sahadev Sharma, Cubs baseball. We're talking it next. I'm Chris Ranji on the Score.
Hey, fantasy football owners, I'm Matt Harmon.
And what's cracking up, James Coe? Join us on Reception Perception as we dive deep into wide receivers, the position that will make or break your fantasy team.
Follow and listen to Reception Perception on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Trying to figure out what to eat for dinner yet again? With Knorr sides and bouillon as your not-so-secret ingredient, you can skip the drive-thru and do dinner at home. Knorr Taste Combos provide a menu of delicious, affordable, and well-balanced meals that you can prepare in 30 minutes or less. Visit Knorr.com to get quick and easy recipe ideas for your home-cooked weeknight dinners. It's not fast food, but it's so good.
From the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking spokes puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare. The hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in store or at mybobs.com to play now.